Okay, this is the hour. We'll take your phone calls with Mac Tonies. Fire away at your stories about structures on Mars, or perhaps what you've heard him say, crypto-terrestrials hidden deep within the bowels of the planet. That'll be all next on Coast to Coast AM. Mac, if you could tackle one area of UFO research right now, fix it, solve it, what would that be?
Where it comes from. from the, just somehow generated by our minds? Is it from space? Is it some unrecognized aspect of existence? What is it? What is it? I think it would be would be ufologist's question.
Would you be able to get that answer?
I don't know. I don't know if that's an answer that our psychology would be able to encompass in a meaningful way. It could be that strange. It could be so strange that we're just not up to comprehending an answer. We might have to evolve for a few million years before we're up to it. Maybe it's not for us. Maybe this is a phenomenon that will make sense to our mechanical predecessors, or successors, rather. I'm sorry.
All right, well, let's go to the phones. Let's pick it up, first of all. Let's go west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air. Where are you calling from?
Los Angeles.
Good. Go ahead, sir.
Hi, George. Hi, Mac.
Hi.
Hi. I wanted to ask, a lot of people listening will say, well, this is fine. It's speculation, but where does it lead us and what good does it do? What would you say to that that opinion?
I would say that it advances an inquiry that has haunted our history from almost its inception. I mean, you go back to ancient Sumeria, for example, and you find the legend of the Oans, this entity from the water that supposedly imparted the wisdom how to create civilization. There seems to be something going on, and it seems to be physical, and it seems to be under some sort of intelligent control. It would behoove the human species if we knew what we were dealing with in terms of whether this is a phenomenon that is here to help us in some way, something we could harness for our own advantage. Is it something that's impeding us, something that's restricting our progress? It shows every sign of being intimately interested in the human experience. So that, to me, signals some alarm bells. It makes me wonder, why this inordinate interest in human affairs? If it's extraterrestrial, why? Likewise, if it's generated here on Earth by some sort of intelligence that we don't recognize or don't understand, why this interest? Because it seems suspicious, frankly. And if we learn something about our own ability to comprehend our universe or our own perceptual abilities in the process, then that's gravy. That's an extra bonus that we should welcome. So there are myriad benefits to understanding this phenomenon. One of its points, and this has been pointed out by others, is that this phenomenon seems to be leading us somewhere, in the sense that it progresses in distinct incarnations, from phantom airships to ghost rockets, whatever. It seems to be one step ahead of what we're presently capable of technologically. So it could be functioning as an evolutionary catalyst. It could be catalyzing or accelerating our own sense of what is possible. And in that sense, it might be some sort of evolutionary trigger. So if we can isolate this, if we could say this is what it is, then that could have profound effects for not only how we think of ourselves as a technological species, but how we propel ourselves into the future.
All right, let's go to Jacksonville, California. Jake, you're up with us. Hey, Jake, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I just had a quick question about an old case. I didn't know if you all heard anything about it. I saw it on the computer the other day, and I didn't ever hear any follow-up to it, because it was probably 15 years ago, but it was the Guardian case. And it was about the, I think it was in Canada or whatever.
I remember reading about that. In fact, that was big when I first got online. I remember seeing some hazy pictures. My impression was that the Guardian case was a hoax. But don't quote me on that. I'd have to go back and research that. It seemed a little too good to be true, quite honestly, to me at the time. And it's one of those things that if I saw it on YouTube now, I'd probably roll my eyes and do a little clicking to figure out what was going on and who was doing it and why. But I'm tempted to say it's a hoax because that was my impression at the time. But I'd have to check.
I was talking with a former Marine who said that the first time he saw a Harrier jet, now for those who don't know what they are, those are planes that will lift up, straight up, you know, just very vertically, and then take off. And he said he saw it in a for a distance, and he thought it was a UFO.
Well, why wouldn't you? They're quite impressive, yeah.
Which brings up the question, how many people are truly seeing man-made craft thinking they're extraterrestrials? And maybe all of them are man-made. What do you think?
I wouldn't say all of them. I think that there is, once you weed out all of the potential IFOs, there is a genuine core phenomenon. There is a genuine burning question at the center of all this. But there's no question that a lot of witnesses are seeing man-made aircraft. And there are more and more man-made aircraft that would qualify as possible, quote-unquote, flying saucers, these disc-shaped drones that we deploy in Afghanistan and Iraq, for example. There are some pretty ingenious designs out there. I don't think any of them would fool an observer for very long if they were very close. But from a distance, certainly they would qualify as your archetypal flying disc. And so that's obviously a factor that that needs to be dealt with. But does this explain the UFO phenomenon? Not a chance.
Let's go to Dixon, Illinois. Simone, it's your turn. Hey, good morning.
Thank you very much. Hi, George, and hi, Mac Tonies.
Hey there.
In regards to the ETH and the Central Intelligence Agency, my question is, how extensive do you think the CIA's responsibility is in perpetrating the ETH, and are they actively ongoing perpetrating it to this very day within ufology, perhaps in the form of NOC agents and so forth? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks
all
very
right,
much.
So I don't think it's CIA, Mac. I think it's a black ops program. I think it's a group beyond the CIA.
It could be both. I do think that the UFO mythos, meaning the extraterrestrial mythos, has been perpetuated by elements in the intelligence community to mask interest, or shun interest, rather, in secret projects. Bob Lazar, for example, comes to mind as a possible someone who was utilized as part of the disinformation campaign. There's the classic story of Paul Benowitz, which Greg Bishop wrote about in his book Project Beta, an excellent book, talking about, you know, why the intelligence community would have an interest in forcing someone or encouraging someone to believe in a literal alien invasion rather than tell them the relatively harmless truth that he'd simply stumbled across transmissions from a base that he wasn't supposed to be receiving transmissions from. So it's a great way not only to make people, lead people down the wrong way, but the laughter curtain, which has been in place for decades, pretty much ensures that the mainstream media will ignore the story. So whenever I hear about crash saucers or underground bases populated by aliens in the Southwest or whatever, I take an interest, not necessarily because I think it's true. I don't think those stories are true. Like I said earlier, the universe contains a maybe. Maybe there's some truth to it. I don't know. But I do pay attention because I wonder if someone could be hiding something. And the same goes for UFO crashes. When I hear about a UFO crash, and I guess the case I'm thinking of in this particular instance is the Roswell crash. Nick Redfern's dug up some intriguing documents to suggest that maybe someone was trying to hide a rather heinous chapter of in history dealing with human experimentation in the desert. And to encourage people to think that a flying saucer from outer space had crashed would be preferable to the ugly human truth. I'm not saying that Nick's hypothesis is necessarily the answer, but it's certainly stimulating to me. So if we're dealing with an element of subterfuge, which I think all the evidence points to the fact that we are, who would be involved, I think, would, like you said, obviously a black budget operation. But
no question about it.
Yeah, but who else would be in on that? That's a good question.
You know, when Hynek changed his views, you know, from being a skeptic for Project Blue Book as their consultant to a believer, to the fact that he set up a UFO studies group out of Chicago. I mean, that told me, Mac, everything I wanted to know at that age, that there was something going on here.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it kind of mirrors Jacques Vallée's trajectory. He started off, you know, thinking this could be explained, although in his case he did think it could be explained as extraterrestrial. And Hynek's views kind of merged, and he became a little more metaphysical. And that's one thing that is profoundly interesting about this phenomenon, is that once you immerse yourself in the stories and the data and the all of it, you're initially struck with the physicality of it. I mean, you realize that there's something going on that leaves traces on the environment. It could be, maybe it's natural, maybe it's whatever, but it's physical. It's not a pop cultural delusion. But the more you look into it, you start scraping away the veneer a little bit and start seeing behind the curtain, there's a metaphysical element to it. And I think that's perhaps just the way our minds react to something so strange. But nevertheless, it suggests that there's a deeper level of meaning. There's a deeper ontology at work here. And that's one of the reasons that I'm interested in the work done by researchers with DMT, who ingest this molecule, report meetings with these strange little elf-like cyborg-looking creatures.
Yeah. I mean, I find that to be weird, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird, but I don't think you can readily dismiss the parallels with the UFO phenomenon as we all understand it. So there are different options about what could be happening. In some cases, I'm not necessarily saying that all UFO cases are due to people tripping on endogenous DMT, but it could be part of it. And if we find out something interesting about the mechanics of our brains, then you know, that's a bonus. You know, ufology offers avenues to learn about the universe that don't necessarily have anything to do with aliens from other planets or from here on Earth, for that matter. And that's one of the interesting things about UFO research that is routinely overlooked by self-proclaimed skeptics who would rather just dismiss it all.
All right, it's time for Joshua now in San Diego. Josh, go ahead.
Hey, how's it going?
Okay, Joshua.
It's great to talk to you. I've been listening for a long time. I just was calling. I've had so many experiences. I'm almost losing count. And when I was younger, I used to kind of, you know, enjoy the thought of maybe getting visited and things like that. And the first times I saw, you know, lights in the sky was with some friends and, you know, and a lot of people, you know, they'll just kind of disregard it or laugh or whatever. And some people listen, you know, kind of whatever. But over the years, it has gotten kind of out of hand, kind of almost scary. And it's not fun. It's terrifying at this point. And sometimes it's so intense and so these encounters that I've had. I'm not talking like face-to-face. I have had, you know, seen a lot of weird people, and I've had conversations with people that I question whether or not they were human.
And, did they look human?
Well, there was one time I saw these things. These people, they looked sort of Ethiopian, I guess you would say. They were almost. They looked Ethiopian, but they meaning like they were black, but they had sort of a green tinge to their skin. And they were probably the most terrifying of all the, you know, the ones that I've met. The other ones just look like normal people. But, you know, my own personal belief is, you know, is that, well, my theory is that, you know, if you're an animal and you're on a farm, you know, grazing or whatever, you know, you're going to be content. You're going to be doing your thing. You're not going to see the farmer very often until the day comes you've got to, you know, the farmer wants to get whatever they need from you. And that's been kind of my experience. I've had, you know, headaches ever since this has been happening.
And have you been studied, Joshua, or have you gone to anybody for this?
I'm terrified. I'm totally terrified. I've kind of been warned, you know. It's not fun. And, you know, I'm mainly calling because I know there's a lot of people out there experiencing this. And, you know, it's like I've heard you say it before, people need to talk about it. And I'm getting kind of emotional about it. But
Well, let me ask you, has this happened to anybody in your family as well? I'm wondering if this is just an ongoing thing with your family.
Well, you know, what's weird is when I was a kid, I had this experience, you know, maybe you call it sleep paralysis, and I've had it since then. But there was one instance when my dad, you know, we lived in Florida. My dad was in the military. We traveled all over, and I've seen him everywhere, all over the United States, everywhere. And there was this one instance where there was these cats in my room, and I woke up, and these cats were literally looking down at me from a corner shelf in my room. They had knocked some books off, and they were really upset about something. You know, a cat, when it's being threatened, it kind of hisses and does this whole thing.
Yeah.
But the strangest thing is there's three of these on the corner shelf, and they were just all stopping, you know, looking. I was terrified as a kid, but I couldn't move. And I don't know what you call willpower or whatever. I knocked over my lamp, and it scared them. They went on the floor, and my dad comes rushing in the room, and he chases these things out. And he remembers this, okay? And the weirdest thing was is that this happened many, many times, and the window in my room was always open. And there's been other times, you know, where I've woken up and been paralyzed, and I thought maybe I've had cats before, so I'm dreaming, and I feel like there's something at the foot of my bed, and I wake up, I'm paralyzed, it moves, and one particular time, it made a cat sound, and I saw, when I chased this thing out of the room, whatever it was in down the hall, there was a window open in the back room. And other people who've been with me have seen the lights. Other people have been sitting with me in a park or something, and weird people will come up and say things to me that at the time I don't know what it means. And that person next to me says, "Hey, what the heck was that about?" And then
let's get Mac's take on this, only because we've got to get to the break pretty soon. And Mac, is his situation, is Joshua's situation unusual compared to other people?
Well, I've read many other similar accounts, even up to the detail of the cats. I mean, I don't like to just come out with the weird possibility first, but, you know, just because we're talking about weird things anyway, some people would say, you know, the cats, you know, as a familiar animal are a screen memory or something like that. I know a guy who he's outdoors a lot, and he had a few occasions where he'd see numerous owls around him a lot, and he thought this was really strange. And he was aware of the screen memory idea, and he made a note to himself that what I'm seeing are really owls.
Well, maybe they're shape-shifting. Who knows? We'll be back with final phone calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, actress Daryl Hannah joins us, along with activist and environmentalist David Bloom, as we talk about alternative energy. That'll be our next hour on Coast to Coast AM. When we come back, we'll take final phone calls, your calls, with Mac Tonies on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Mac Tonies, our special guest tonight. Final calls with Mac. And your stories as well. Tell me a little bit about your work with the UFO documentary Best Evidence.
That was a documentary produced by Red Star Films of Nova Scotia, Canada. And it was a good bit-by-bit kind of laying out the phenomenon in an unbiased way. The film was kind of produced with the idea, like, here is the phenomenon for what it is.
We're not drawing any conclusions about it, but these are 10 very good cases. Explain them if you can. And I was not featured in one of the UFO cases per se, but I had a little commentary at the end, taken here in Kansas City, up the street. But it's a good movie. It's a good film. It's set, not your typical UFO movie in the sense that it's not your usual format where you have a virulent debunker versus a completely wild-eyed believer, you know, for the sake of being fair and balanced. It was,
right.
You know, the cases stand up for the cases that they are. And one of them was the Malmstrom case with the nuclear warheads going off one by one. Certainly an interesting case. One of them was the case where a spy plane was followed and apparently tracked and even communicated electromagnetically with an unknown object. Certainly a puzzling case. And there were others, but I particularly like the film. I didn't make the film, by the way. It was made by Paul Kimball. He's the director. But I accompanied Paul for some of the filming, and had a really good time. I think it stands up as a good documentary, and I hope it gets some deserved airplay in the United States.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go to the final calls. First-time caller, we're going to Palmer, Alaska. Jay is up there. Go ahead, Jay. You're up.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Yes. How are you doing this evening?
Go ahead, Jay.
Good. But I have to talk about an incident that happened back in the mid-80s. If you want to see phenomena, you look up. But anyway, to make a long story short and fit this in, I worked at a satellite tracking station for 30 years, and I took care of microwave sites in remote areas of Alaska.
Okay, very good.
I was traveling up the highway into a site, to a tower about 3,500 feet up a mountainside. The snow was heavy the night before. It had cleared off. This was in early December, about 85. The air is perfectly clear. It's 45 below zero. Going up, plowing the road to get to the top of this microwave site, suddenly everything lit up with blue-white pulsating light. My first impression, I froze. I said, they did it. A nuke has gone off. The entire countryside was lit up. Okay? I dropped my blade. I pushed up to about 1,100, 1,200 feet where I had a turnout. I could look out, and across the face of the Alaska Range was a craft. I would estimate it at 2 to 2.5 miles long. I would estimate it at about a half a mile to 3/4 of a mile wide, and it was slightly tilted as it went across the face of the mountain. The flashing, pulsating light had a diameter of about 50 to 75 miles in all directions. I watched this craft silently as it went across the face of Mount McKinley at about 18,000 feet. I was no more than 25 miles from this craft, and this was a craft. I watched it for at least 10 to 12 minutes. It wasn't traveling that fast. It was seen in Cantwell, which is 100 miles away, about 10 minutes before I saw it 100 miles further south. Okay? The last time I see it, it's going out over the ocean about 60 miles north of Anchorage, Alaska. And I watched it go out of sight. Now, what's amazing about this, I reported this to a paper in Fairbanks, right?
Okay.
They took my call. This is on a Friday night, all right? I spent the night in Cantwell. What's amazing is this craft was never reported by anyone else in Alaska but me. I know that Clear Air Force Base, which is an Air Force base about 300 miles from where I live in Palmer, north, just this side of Fairbanks, that they scrambled jets and could not get close to it. I heard that scuttlebutt through the line a few days later. Now, when I got back to the satellite station where I worked, they were making fun of me. I saw the light and all this kind of stuff. I didn't say anything.
Could it have been mistaken for the aurora?
Oh, no, my friend. I watched this craft. Just a minute. I'll finish this story. Okay, that night, two truck drivers pulled into a... It's about 7 o'clock at night. They pulled in, came into the cafe on the highway where I had stopped in there in Cantwell. And one said to the other, "Hey, Joe, what did you think that thing was?" There were two different drivers and two different trucks. And he said, "My God, I don't know." He said, "But it scared the hell out of me. Did you see the light from it?" I walked over and asked him. I said, "What did you guys see?" Like, I hadn't seen anything myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they told me. They gave me what they saw. Then two people from Cantwell that I know, one guy that owns the town of Cantwell and a guide there named Ray Atkins, walked in. And they said, "We're talking about it." And I walked over to them. They said, "John, it came right over us." You know,
so people saw it, but they just didn't report it.
Well, Alaska's a small state, and a lot of stuff happens. But the final thing on this craft was, later, a week or so later, the news hit the airwaves that this craft was seen in seven countries. It had come across Russia and came over the Bering Straits. Alaska's very sparsely populated, and where it came from was just villages, just Arctic villages and things, as it came down the Alaska Range. But how in the heck could you hide something like this if this was something the U.S. government had or the military had? That's impossible.
Nothing that big, Jay. And what year was this about?
Well, you know, I had the clipping from the paper for a long time. I lived in Talkeetna. I moved to Palmer.
Okay, yeah.
Talkeetna, Alaska. We built the first earth station there and sent a signal around the world out of Talkeetna, Alaska, a village of about 500-600 people at the time, through a communications satellite corporation. And we built seven earth stations across the world and sent that signal. We put the first live signal on the satellite Aurora 1 out of Alaska in 1970. Okay, and that's where I worked. But anyway, that information about that was kind of blown over, you know, about that incident. And I asked several people that saw it, said, "Yeah, it looked like a big arc in the sky from where they were. But I saw this craft completely for at least 10 to 12 minutes."
And again, what year, Jay?
I would say it was 84, 85. I could find out. I could dig through the archives.
Yeah, if you could, because I'd like to track that. Now, is there any way, Mac, that people would, you know, see clouds and think this is a huge craft? I don't think so. This was an incredible description.
Yeah, I would agree. I also find it significant that it was seen leaving across the ocean. If you wanted to hide something, and let's say it wasn't made by us, but if you wanted to hide something, the Earth is mostly ocean. And there are a number of very, very credible reports of exotic vehicles entering and exiting bodies of water. And that's actually a notion that I play with in the crypto-terrestrials, is that we could be sharing the planet with beings that are primarily aquatic, at least in the sense of living underwater, not having evolved there. But what a great place for a remote base if you wanted to live nearby and keep an eye on the human population, but stay out of its hair.
So, I distinctly remember a case where a number of countries reported seeing a huge object. This could be the one.
I was wanting to say it was one of the cases that was in best evidence, but after the size of it doesn't fit. But
Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Dave, go ahead. You're up with us.
Mac, George, can I coin a phrase of one of our favorite sci-fi guys? Fascinating.
Thank you.
Okay, I was born in Chester, Pennsylvania in 1958. We moved to Westtown, Pennsylvania in 1962. That's when it all started for me. Farmland all around, easy place for a craft to land. I started getting visitations for what I called the little people. And Mom goes, "Honey, you were dreaming." And I go, "Mom, I wasn't dreaming." Okay, the encounters happen regularly, every couple of months, twice every couple of months. They just let me remember this one specific time. There was three beings in my room, one to my right, one at the foot of my bed, and one to my left, which I felt was female, so we'll call her she. She put her hand on my arm and said, "We've seen you before, and we'll see you again." Okay, boom, back to sleep. Fast forward into my adulthood. Went to my dentist, get a routine x-ray, comes back. He says, "Have you ever had brain surgery?" I go, "No." He says, "Well, it was something in your nasal passage." He looked at the x-ray. X-ray tech looked at the x-ray. I looked at the x-ray. There was definitely something there. Fast forward a little more. I go back to the dentist. I go, well, let's see the x-ray. I want to, you know, see if it's right. He goes, it's not on the x-ray. So I'm thinking, like, okay, maybe government, maybe alien. I don't know, but it disappeared.
So it was there, but it was gone. That is weird.
Yeah, that is weird. I mean, do you think it was the government or do you think it was the aliens that did it, you know?
That's a good guess, Mac.
Well, the implant phenomenon is interesting because a lot of the times when they extract these things, it's like it's nothing that points the arrow at exotic technology. It's like some weird, maybe it has some anomalous properties, but it's nothing that we couldn't manufacture if we really wanted to. So it almost makes me wonder if the implant phenomenon, much like some of the UFO phenomenon itself, is essentially maybe a diversion of some kind to make us think that something's happening. There's an element of theater that you find in UFO cases, in occupant cases, that intrigues me a great deal. Even the fact that UFOs have such bright flashing lights in so many reports, it's almost like these craft want to be seen, or they make themselves seen to just a few people at a time or whatever. And elements of the implant mystery kind of lend themselves to a similar interpretation. It makes me wonder if that object had been removed, if we'd find anything that would really resolve the UFO implant controversy. I would be tempted to say it wouldn't. It would just be another weird little thing. But yeah, the implant phenomenon is fascinating because I do think that objects are being removed, whether they're technologically sophisticated objects or essentially little placeholders, little mischievous post-it notes or something. I don't know.
Let's go to Ontario, Canada on the international line, Mac. We've got Greg there. Greg, go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning.
During the last segment, both of you gentlemen made comments about humans being a technological species and also about people not being able to recognize different kinds of aircraft. For example, you mentioned the Harrier jump jet. I would submit that we're actually not a technological species because even though we use a lot of it, most people don't understand it.
That's very true. Robert Heinlein had a famous line that we are, specialization is for insects. Humans need to branch out and be able to do a little bit of everything. And we have a very small minority of our population that's actually adept at technology. The rest of it just kind of blindly use it, and it might as well be magic for all we know. I know that's certainly the case with parts of my computer and my cell phone. I understand the idea behind it. Carl Sagan made a nice analogy. If we took a TV back to Victorian England, gave it to the top engineers of the time and said, build this for us, you know, they might be able to understand some of the mechanisms involved. You know, they'd understand, for example, that the beings on the screen, assuming there was a TV signal, weren't real people. It was an image. But they wouldn't even be able to begin to build a TV in Victorian England. So we're presented with possibly much the same thing today with the UFO phenomenon. And certainly so few of us are so schooled in the workings of technology. It's almost as if a symbiosis has been reached. We've reached technology is almost kind of an organism in its own right. And that's actually one of the things that makes me think that we will begin to merge on an organic level in the next 100 years. In fact, I would submit that we will ultimately have to in order to survive.
Let's go to Panama City, Florida. Alex, east of the Rockies, there you are. Go ahead, Alex.
Hey, I wanted to ask, I just want to let you know that that previous caller that had been talking about, you know, he was having the night paralysis and whatever. You know, I went through that a lot when I was younger, and it finally stopped when I was about 22. But the question that I had was, you were talking about structures on the moon, and I know I don't really trust a whole lot that I see on YouTube, but I came across a video where Neil Armstrong, one of the Apollo, you know, astronauts, and they were walking around on the surface of the moon, and he says, and he's talking to ground control, and he says, hey, do you guys see these structures? And it looks like, you know, an apartment complex or something like that, abandoned, but, you know, that kind of a structure. And ground control's like, yes, we know about it. Go to the left. And he keeps moving towards it and, you know, saying, no, no, do you guys see this? And they keep telling him, yes, we know about it. Go the other way. And I was also wondering if you knew that there was any truth to him saying, Neil Armstrong saying, you know, that they had come across some entities on the moon and had pretty much been told, hey, leave and don't come back. And that's also kind of why Buzz Aldrin is like, we don't need to go back to the moon. We already know all about it. Let's go to Mars.
Well, Buzz Aldrin, in a recent interview, made reference to a fairly enigmatic structure on the surface of Phobos. It's basically the steeple-like protrusion on an otherwise very flat, rounded moon. And to the best of my knowledge, this strange feature was identified by Efrain Palermo. His website's palermoproject.com. He's an independent Mars researcher. And I found that interesting that Aldrin would specifically mention this particular feature. And when I say structure, I don't mean that it was necessarily built by anybody, but it is odd, and it definitely looks like a candidate anomaly. It's certainly classified as such. As for the videos of Armstrong, I've read reports like that in sources that are not very credible. I've never seen any. I'd have to see the original broadcast or listen to the original broadcast to make any sort of judgment on that. I've got to say I'm extraordinarily skeptical of the whole aliens on the moon thing. There's a certain seductive logic to it, I suppose, but I've never seen anything that would make me think that there's any factual basis to it.
Okay, thanks, Alex. Let's take, I don't know, maybe we can squeeze one more in for you. John, time for a quick question. Go ahead.
Yes, this is John in California. Earlier, he'd mentioned that you were thinking the Grays were robots.
Yes.
Well, my question is why couldn't they be genetic robots? Kind of like the H.G. Wells cross-contamination protection.
Absolutely.
And there's been instances where they've been kind of warm towards humans, kind of had human characteristics, where they've kind of learned using our DNA to be more compassionate.
Well, it's kind of like where do you draw the line between replicants, or excuse me, where do you draw the line between human and robot? On a certain level, a living organism is a very complex machine. I think the replicant word, like I dropped the replicant, not the word replicant.
Well, they can definitely be part biological and part machine indeed. Mac, thank you so much. Websites linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back.